Welcome to the Red Passport, the useful nation. That's how one foreign minister, not so many years ago, described Canada. A firm partner of the U.S.? Absolutely. A founding member of NATO? Check. A country of the so-called West or Global North? You bet. But also a middle power that could reach across the big divides of the day. We could listen to what the world was saying. We could speak truth to our friends south of the border. We could even try, on occasion, to bridge the difference. I'm Peter DiNolo in Toronto, with Jeremy Kinsman in Victoria and Louise Blais just outside Quebec City. And our question today is very simple. In a world where the dividing lines seem more firmly drawn than at any time since the end of the Cold War, is that bridge role even still possible? Today's leaders talk a lot more about walls than bridges. Maybe that image last month of the destroyed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore is a fitting symbol for this new age. Is that the fate of bridge building in 2024? So let's get into it. The world's changed. I guess we've changed too. Should we just get over it and move on? What do you guys think? Jeremy.
Well, I don't know. Move on to what? That's the problem. We don't know where the world's going. I certainly agree that the world is divided, but it's also fragmented. You know, and the old east-west dividing line is kind of smudged now, and the big dividing line out there, if you just make an exception of the kind of manic, obsessive belief on Putin's part in the virtues and value to the world of Russian state civilization, which I don't think the world buys very much. The big divide is back to what it was in the 70s, and that is north-south. And in answer to your question, I know we don't want to talk about, you know, people in the past as if it was the golden age. But, you know, Trudeau bridged that. He asked, who is my neighbor?
Pierre Trudeau.
The Pierre Trudeau. Yeah, yeah.
Got to get our Trudeau straight here.
Yeah, we'll get our Trudeau. You should get our Trudeau straight because they're very different. And we were very different. And we should discuss about why it's different. But what he reflected was an empathy with the condition of people who aren't like us. Okay. And that, gosh, that was a generational thing. So many Canadians of my generation went abroad, you know, for CUSO, for CETA, for all sorts of NGOs, went to Zambia, they went to all sorts of countries and have lived their lives in empathy with them. And somehow we've lost the connection, and we've lost maybe self-belief in our confidence to be able to try to understand.
Okay, a crisis of confidence then. Louise, do you think we're having a crisis of confidence?
Well, before we get to that, Peter, I just want to build a little bit on what Jeremy was saying. Things have changed. So has the South. And that approach that you were describing, I think, was very appropriate at the time. But today, the Global South wants to be seen as a partner, an equal partner, as opposed to a recipient of largesse from the West. And I think that's the pivot that Canada has not fully made. I would argue the United States as well. And you know, I very much felt it when I was at the UN, because you saw the dynamics of negotiation, and the G77, which is basically is the Global South plus China, it's over 125 countries now out of 193 members that really band together, and they have a lot more humph and diplomatic influence than they ever have. And I think we've been a little too slow to adapt to that reality.
Also, don't we assume in the West that they're going to buy on to the same values and campaigns we do? You know, we think they're going to be reflexively as concerned about China or Russia as our Western allies are. But actually, China and Russia are opening their pocketbooks to those countries. What do you guys think? I mean, is that, we all came out of the 90s hopeful about a kind of new world order, the end of history. I don't think so. But a new world order where, you know, China was coming on board with the trade structures of the world. Russia was leaving totalitarianism behind it, and I guess we set ourselves up to have our hearts broken. And now we're surprised when other countries that, you know, didn't have the same historical experiences we had with those two countries don't feel as offended and angry as we do. You know, maybe we should get in their wavelength a bit.
Yeah, look, I agree with Louise, but I think Canada has been fairly distinctive in not viewing the Third World as just the object of largesse. Going back to Pierre Trudeau again, if I may, I mean, he tried to get the G7, as it was then, back in 1980, the first time we chaired it and hosted it, to agree on the theme of power sharing. It was all about enhancing the influence of those countries. And today, after globalization, I mean, some of those countries are really angry. If you look at the IMF, voting rights, 57% of the voting rights are held by countries with 13% of the world's population. India and China, both 1.4 billion, only have 9%. They're saying, who makes the rules? Who's running the game? And what I think that we can do in the UN, much more than we have, is actually make that case to some extent against our own caste of privileged developed countries, and to make it strenuously. Because the world is, in terms of the organization of power and influence, it's lopsided still on behalf of the winners of 60, 70 years ago. And I think Louise, that's a major problem.
Could we do that? Could Canada pick up the banner and actually lead that kind of meaningful the UN and international architecture reform that Jeremy's talking about?
Maybe eventually. I don't think we have the kind of credibility to do that now. I think it's been too entrenched now over the past 20 years that we've been really very much on the U.S. camp when it comes to major issues. And I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that we're being treated fairly, to be honest. But, you know, when we have, the Middle East is a perfect example. We're nuancing our position today, but it was a little late in the game. Historically, I think we've been misunderstood, certainly our position has, by you know, the Global South in general, being so supportive of Israel and not enough of the idea of a Palestinian state. And, you know, just interestingly enough, that old debate is coming back at the UN, and now we're going to have to pick side again. And this is how it crystallizes how Canada is viewed. But the Palestinians are asking for full membership. A letter has been written, and obviously they're going to receive the support of the Global South, and part of the West will oppose it. And so this goes on. And so it makes it difficult for us to really crystallize a different approach to how we deal with them. And they're very sensitive now that when I say I'm generalizing the Global South in a double standard and, you know, saying one thing, doing another. And I think we've seen a lot of that, and it's going to take years to rebuild trust. And we would have to be extremely steady in
Previous generations have also had to overcome this kind of stuff, you know, the deep suspicions. They built the UN while the Cold War was raging. And a lot of these international institutions, I mean, we have as Canada's representative of the UN now, one of our country's true statesmen, Bob Rae. Isn't he the kind of guy who could actually think outside the box and get moving on some of this stuff?
Yeah, I think so. But look, it's not a question of saying. It's a question, I think, as Louise was saying, it's a question of doing. I mean, we've got to show that we're out there. I disagree that it's not the role of a developed country to do this. You circulated an article, I think, from the London Review of Books, Peter, last week to us.
By Pankaj Mishra.
Yeah, yeah. And basically, he was making a point. I hadn't thought of it before. But he was making a point which is made a lot by Indians. When the West have gone to India, to Modi and to the foreign minister to say, you got to support us on Ukraine because it's your fight too, and stop, you know, buying all that Russian oil. The foreign minister said, you know, your problems aren't ours, and ours aren't yours. And I think there is a case that Canada can identify those problems and support some of the demands, if you want, But he also made the point about Gaza that hadn't occurred to me, that the Palestinians are seen in so much of the global south as representing the same kind of condition that these countries inherited through the history of colonization. And it is, to some extent, strangely, a kind of a color thing. Canada is a multicolored country, and we have to relate to that. Israel is seen in most of the world as being a Western, advanced, developed country. And what Louise says is the principal problem is inconsistency, that we do have double standards. And I think we got to be braver. That's not a question of being against Israel. Of course not. It's a question of acknowledging the validity of some of these grievances and working to change the institutions which we commonly own to work for everybody more fairly.
Well, you know, I agree. And I just want to make a point here. We're talking about leadership and who can lead and not lead. What's interesting is a lot of it does come down to personality as well and relationships. And you see small countries at the UN and elsewhere, whether the Singapore's or the Ecuador's, stand up sometimes and really move things along. It was Liechtenstein that helped pass that UN, that General Assembly resolution that would force anyone of the P5 using their veto having to come and explain themselves into the General Assembly. Leadership and Peter, you mentioned Bob Rae. Of course, who's your ambassador at the UN matters. Who's your prime minister matters. And there's a lot of official meetings that go on, but the conversations in the background, and we heard a lot of that in the eulogy to Brian Mulroney, that it really wasn't just that he was the prime minister of Canada. It's he personally, as a human being, had influence. And I think that will always be important in diplomacy, is the personal ability and leadership and charisma of those and those.
You talk about the smaller countries that have actually, you know, as Canadians love to say, punched above their weight, as they used to love to say. Two in particular that we've talked about before, Ireland and Norway, which actually kind of edged us out for the National Security Council last time we were up for it. What can we learn from them?
Well, I think they do punch above their weight. I mean, mind you, Norway is in a very enviable position of having, you know, I think probably upwards toward $1 trillion. But they do. And Ireland has a history of you know, neutrality. They do themselves see themselves as kind of past victims of colonization. And so they're popular. But let me ask you a question. Something's happened in Canada to make a difference. Is it possible that being as almost uniquely now an immigration recipient country, we're about the only country in the world now out looking for immigrants, trying to bring them in, and they come in, and they're great, and they're here, but in fact they're an increasingly high proportion of our country, but the question is, our politics increasingly see them now as voters.
You know, it's interesting because I think you're right. You know, in the past, foreign policy was like a snoozer for a campaign. It was never an issue in campaigns. You know, sometimes, obviously, Canada-US is a foreign policy issue. That would be an issue because it's so defining for our country. But you know, Canada and the world was rarely an issue. That started changing about 20 years ago, Louise mentioned it, when we started changing our votes at the UN. We had always been a firm ally of Israel, but that didn't mean that we would vote in lockstep with the US on Middle Eastern issues. That started changing about 2004.
And yeah, but it's gone farther than that.
We fractionalized
our politics into trying to appeal to very specific diaspora constituencies, an impact in our parliamentary system on who wins the parliamentary seat in three or four places. So we have a Sikh foreign policy. We have a Tamil foreign policy. Yeah. We had, obviously, a Ukrainian foreign policy.
Well, look, there's an inquiry taking place as we speak about the influence that the Chinese government's trying to exert on Chinese Canadians in the political arena. So, yeah, I think these are all factors. You know, it's kind of interesting. This has been a reality in the U.S. for decades. In Canada, you know, the question is, these matters are a bit of chicken and egg. I mean, in the sense that, yeah, these constituencies are there. We've always had large ethnic constituencies, but these constituencies are there. The difference is it takes leaders who will say no based on the merits of the case, or yes based on the merits of the case, not just because they think that there's votes in it for them.
Well, it's more the merits of the case. It's merits of the state.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our national interest.
To the specific community.
Yeah. Yeah, so I do think that's changed. And I think, listen, all parties practice it now. So I think we can, you know, they can point at each other, but each of them have ways of, ways of trying to micro-target different profiles of voters in this country. And this is the ways they do it. It's one of the ways they do it. And I don't think it's a healthy development. I think it takes away from our ability to speak honestly and act constructively around the world, to be that useful nation. And like, I want to repeat, it's not like in the past that we were some kind of neutral Switzerland-like country. We certainly were not. We were a firm member of NATO, firmly on one side of the Cold War, but we still tried to build bridges. I mean, Jeremy said, since you started talking about the past, let me go back even further. Diefenbaker with Cuba, when our entire hemisphere, you know, turned against Cuba on American orders, Diefenbaker didn't. Diefenbaker also, you know, imposed sanctions on the South African government over apartheid. Diefenbaker also had an independent policy on China, building bridges to China through wheat sales when other countries, wouldn't. So again, you can be a member of whatever bloc we're in, but still not be slavish to it. Louise, what do you think?
Well, I completely agree. And, you know, I find, and this is what I was trying to get at earlier, I really do find that we have a separate foreign policy than the United States. I think you've just cited some examples. I could come up with 10 more. You know, we didn't go to Iraq. We didn't, you know, there's completely, as you said, completely different policy on Cuba, different policy when Trump was president on reproductive rights for women across the world, a whole variety of things. And I find that, you know, I can tell you when I was at the UN and we diverged, we didn't have the same opinion, or even when we did, we either didn't get the calls to tell us, except for one time when Nikki Haley said that she was taking names, but she was taking everyone's.
Was your name one of them?
Yeah, well, she no, on that one we were as pretty aligned to the Americans' position on at the time on this one, but no, they are willing to let us have our own position. And it's very rare, it's been very rare that I've seen in my diplomatic career on the third issue, something not having to do with Canada-US, where they actually called us to say, hey, we're very unhappy with you. I mean, yes, George W. Bush wasn't thrilled with Jean Chrétien's position, but they were much more upset with de Villepin, the French minister at the time, or prime minister, I think. He was going around the world trying to in opposition to the American policy, which we did not do. We wouldn't do that. We are not going to go around campaign against the United States, but we have had an independent foreign policy for quite some time. But
you know, it's interesting. One thing that I think has changed, because you guys asked among what are the things that have changed, I think one thing that's changed is the tenor of Canadian media, in particular our newspapers, which I know don't get the kind of readership they used to, but between the Globe and Mail and the Post, the Post media papers, they're you know, by far the largest organs in the markets across the country. And really, since 9/11, they have had a hardline view when it comes to foreign policy. They have, every time we've diverged with the U.S., particularly on the Iraq War, as you mentioned, they were just brutal and super critical. They've been, in my view, quite colonial in their mindset when it comes to foreign policy. And we see it whenever there's a big issue. In fact, I think the Globe and Mail, for example, is literally sinophobic. in the sense of, yeah, China is a huge issue. China is a huge adversary, also a huge trade partner. But I mean, there they are. If you want to talk single-minded in their coverage, just look at the Globe and Mail. So I think they've created the media, the Globe and the Post media together, have created this environment that makes it, that does create pressures on governments and on parties on all sides.
You're absolutely right. And I think there's a more egregious illustration of it. Put the papers aside, because the papers do, at the end of the day, reflect the interests of the publishers who own them. Okay. And so it's a personal thing in there and their personal disposition to be critical on those issues. But look at the CBC website in English and look for foreign world stories. Look for reporting on elections, the Polish election or any election that's going on. You'll see many more items, articles on that website in English on animals in Canada than you'll see about human beings in countries other than Canada. It's a me first kind of soft news thing, and it's our public broadcasting.
Yeah, but that's not ideological, whereas the stuff with the other with the papers is firmly and
sharply ideological. It's not ideological, but it very, very much contributes to making Canadian preoccupations increasingly parochial, okay? If you watch 2460, 24/60 in French, you'll see an entirely different perspective, and you'll see examinations in depth of country after country after country in the world, and it has an audience. You know, I think that that there is a declining interest, and it's fomented, it's nourished by the parochialism of our media, without any question.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that worries me, particularly this year, is, you know, the U.S. election is a huge distraction. And that's the one exception probably about foreign affairs. I mean, there's an enormous amount of interest in what's happening south of the border. And I think that, you know, all the hyped up anxiety about the democratic process, about potential return of Donald Trump, and all of this is out there in as a huge sort of a focus of interest. And I'm worried that this is actually distracting Canadians for what really matters and what are the challenges that we have at home, and what do we need to do for our country to be more resilient in its foreign policy in general. So I think that there's a sense of sometimes, you use the word parochial, and I think that's correct. I think sometimes there's a sense of arrogance that Canada has certain things figured out, and we look down at other democracies, even in other countries. And I think that's something that we need to change, going back to a more, it's just kind of the balance between having a sort of clear-eyed view, of Canada and our strengths and weaknesses, and at the same time a little bit more of an open attitude vis-a-vis others that are not like us.
Yeah, I think that's so true. You know, with the parochialism that you guys have talked about, there's also along with it a kind of moralism, which to me is very off-putting, which is basically our media, left, right, center, they all basically say we should only be talking to other countries with whose values we share, which is crazy. As Louise, you talked about the number of countries at the UN that can be considered, you know, the Western world is pretty small. The same with world population, overwhelmingly outside of this community of nations. And if all we do is talk to like-minded people, we're never going to change anyone's mind. We're never going to have any influence in the world. The whole point of diplomacy is to actually reach out and talk to people who you don't agree with and find common ground.
No, that's true, Peter. But be fair. I think that Madame Joly has made exactly that point of being pragmatic. But it's got to go beyond talk. We've got to show that we can deliver. I always experienced abroad, and including at the UN for 5 years, that Canada had the benefit of being seen by other countries as being secure in our own authenticity of who we are. And I think that's kind of what we've lost. One of the things that we are is the other North America. And we've lost our confidence in that other part. And as the other North America, we've got a lot of attractive play around the world. In Africa and Latin America, people want to see us as the other North America.
Listen, I remember
the Americanism, but as another version of North America.
I remember Mr. Krechian saying that one of the assets, big assets we had around the world was that we were North American but not American. We spoke French. We had all the American technology and know-how, and we didn't have a colonial baggage carried on our backs.
Well, so, I think those are truisms, and they're all true.
So what happened? How did we drop this?
We're speaking less French than we used to, let me tell
you. That's true.
And that's a great pity. I fault the public service for that. It's really lapsed in that. I don't know, Louise, if you're in agreement with me, but the use of French in meetings in Ottawa has declined from the 1960s precipitously.
And nowhere more than at Global Affairs.
Yeah.
And we used to have a true bilingual, bicultural back then, and now it should be multicultural diplomacy. We had some of the greats coming, having, you know, from French Canada, being, you know, serving side by side with our English Canadian friends, and it was really a strength. And I was shocked when I arrived, and of course that is Le Devoir did a piece a few years ago. Lamenting. The fact that we really didn't have at that time any deputy ministers, and we have a few in the department, and assistant deputy ministers who were francophone, and they fixed it a little bit, but not fundamentally now. But I remember when I arrived at the UN, everything that came, well, in fact, all the time, all the statements, all the speeches that Ottawa would send to us to give were all in English. And I would refuse to give an only unilingual English statement,
right,
unless I was speaking on behalf of Cannes or a group of other countries. But if I was speaking on behalf of Canada, I would have to translate it myself on the fly in the seat, because I could never get them in, because it would always be written in English. And it was never enough time to translate it. And so they kind of shrugged and they said, well, you know, that's all we can do. And it was, so you're thinking no one's drafting statements at the department in French. And that was really quite telling. And
on pourrait même faire cette émission en français complètement, si on voulait.
Bien sûr, un jour.
Jeremy, vas-tu la prochaine fois?
Oui, la prochaine fois, on va le faire en français. Moi, j'ai travaillé des ambassades qui étaient des ambassades désignées comme francophones.
Listen,
and now, years, we had a French mission, and everything we put out was in French. And then gradually, you began to realize that half of your audience, your important audience you were trying to connect to, wasn't reading it, you know, because it was in French. And so the goodwill was there. But people didn't enforce it in practice. And
This the kind of stuff. This tone is set from the top. And I'll be honest with you. I worked in a prime minister's office that was absolutely bilingual. You could not be a senior staffer if you weren't bilingual. Meetings were in English, were often in French. And that's the way it went. Now we've had a number of prime ministers since then, successively, who are surrounded by unilingual Anglophones. I hate to say it, guys, but that's a fact. And that has an impact all the way down through the public service.
Yeah, it does. I mean, look, I never spoke English to Mr. Peltier, for example. I wouldn't dare. But now, with the chief of staff of the prime minister, I don't know if Katie Telford speaks French or not, but you know, the unilingual people who are running the show, if you're a francophone, you have to speak in their language in order to make your case. And it's dysfunctional if you're pretending to be a bilingual country. One of the other issues is, you know, I'm all pro-immigration, so don't get me wrong. But I think that we have to be much more emphatic. And in this way, I'm sort of with Legault, because so many of our immigrants come, and for them, this is an English-speaking country. And it does, you know, French, the French presence is deteriorating. But anyway, listen.
But no, I think these are all valid points. So let's put a capper on that one. You know, you cannot get into an Ivy League school in the U.S. if you don't have a second language proficiency. Yet Canadian universities would never consider employing that.
We can discuss this. This is, I think, the Global Affairs Canada, I've argued for this, should announce it that in 5 years from now, it will not entertain any applicants that don't speak at least two, if not three languages. And give people time to go and do their study, prepare for that. But no, we bring in unilingual speakers, and then we send them on language training for a year or two, and then they come back. And then we send them on a posting. Let's say they're Anglophone. We send them on an to an English-speaking country, and they completely lose the French that we've paid to train them to learn. No, there has to be a better way. We have to encourage. We have to find a way that it's not a means to an end for a promotion. That it's a way of life, and that there is joy and pride in understanding our diversity and our culture. And as opposed to just trying to get to that C level so you can get your promotion, which is what
it is. So well said. So we've talked about how improving our, getting back to the bilingualism of the Foreign Service can be a positive thing, and the multilingualism would be a positive thing. We've got a few more minutes before we wind up. You know, we've kvetched a lot on this show about, you know, the world changing, Canada changing, what's wrong. Let's just talk for a couple of minutes about, top of the head, some practical steps that we could take to really make a difference.
Well, I think the most important thing to start with is that the whole experience is one of mutual learning. That we've got as much to learn from other countries as they have to learn from us. The whole idea that, you know, to be a developed, successful democracy, you simply have to imitate the democracies who already exist, it's long gone. It went down the drain in 2008 with the financial crisis, when it was apparent the people running things didn't know what they were doing. You know, I think our greatest asset is our people. And I very much would have hoped that all of the new Canadians, okay, kids of first generation generally feel very emphatically Canadian, but it's to bring us all into a picture, our own picture of Canada, that everybody can really relate to, and not sectionalize it, whatever country you came from. And we're blessed because our immigrants come from so many different countries, not like some countries who receive immigrants just from two or three, and different religions. I do think we need a more beneficial kind of generous nationalism in Canada that is internationalist. Our personality is internationalist. And I think that's what, and Canadians communicate that. You know, Canadian citizens abroad communicate that. They're the purveyors of our foreign policy as much as people in global affairs.
Yeah, I'm going to take it from that big, expansive to perhaps argue for a parallel, if not another avenue. I think we need to, as for our foreign policy, I think we need to make some choices. I think we need to be clear. We just don't have the resources to be everything to everyone. And, you know, we talk about this from time to time. I mean, look at a country like France. It has the European Union that helps it in its foreign policy, and it's a bigger country than us. No, I think we need to prioritize certain issues, certain things where Canada could make a very strong contribution, and be consistent with those, and continue on, whether it's the Arctic or NATO or you know, human rights, whatever it may be. We need to just make a selection, be clear to our partners, look, this is what we're going to focus on. You can count on us for this. And it's not going to change if another government is elected. It'd be great to have a bit of a foreign policy for a country our size that was more, I come back, to the point that was more consistent and doesn't flip-flop all the time. We just don't have the luxury of a superpower foreign policy. And I think it should be focused and it should be nationally accepted and not the playing, sort of the playground of politicians to bat around, and because that's damaging for us internationally.
Okay,
well, you just defined what Norway does. That's what they do exactly.
So here's my challenge.
Here's my
challenge to you guys and to us. Let's make that the focus of our next few episodes. Let's talk about what those areas ought to be. You know, Louise mentioned a few interesting ones. You could also throw in climate change as one. There's a whole bunch, you know, where you have to actually reach across and talk to people like India and China, with whom we don't necessarily have the best relationships now. But it's a common cause is something to build a good relationship on. Anyway, I think that's a lot of fodder for future talks. And I think a lot more relevant for people who are listening and who, you know, despite our war stories, don't want to spend all the time talking about the past and really want to focus on the future. So with that, I'm going to say thanks for listening. And please get back to us with your feedback and your questions. In the meantime, we hope you'll tune in to Ruth Mohid Ramirez's Open Canada podcast, which is also hosted by the CIC. Ruth talks to outstanding Canadians who are making the kind of difference in the world that Jeremy and Louise and I just discussed. Until next time, on behalf of Louise Blais, Jeremy Kinsman, and me, Peter DiNolo, thanks for listening.